Before I forget, though, since you mentioned this fellow out at Northrop, do you have any notion of what happened to both he consolidated records and any links that there might be to the old Volte Corporation, which I gather now must be General Dynamics? But I was wondering how to, since Volte also was so important, if there was a way to trace them down at all.
I don't know of any. They're supposed, they all have internally, they have somebody that is doing this under some mm-hmm. label. And at Long Beach, you have a fellow named Harry Gann.
He doesn't seem to, so I've been working from the high schools in Long Beach mm-hmm. to train their students to do oral history as part of their U.S. history classes. And one of them apparently interviewed him, and there wasn't very much
no, Harry,
there, it didn't seem to me.
Harry, I think he's building up for his retirement so that he can live off. He collects photographs and history right and left. And I know Harry very well, and I know when people complain that he does a minimum amount of work for them. Ira Chart's number, in case you want to talk to him, is 970-4489. Mm-hmm. I'm just noticing the Times this morning. They had quite a section, kind of the women in industry type thing. This is, as long as I can remember, there have been pictures like this, and generally the same information. It's upgraded a little, the vocabulary's changed, so it sounds more sophisticated. But that's as of today. Now, I ran off a couple of things here that you can look at as the way it was publicized way back. And to me, it's interesting that it looks just about the same. Mm-hmm. I thought about Helen. It's another bit too clean a job there. I guess it's in the back of here. I made these copies so you can take them with you.
Oh, thank
but
you.
But you'll find that that these are articles that came out, and particularly the snood
right.
was so much in vogue at that time. And
Because I was gathering some photographs to send the story out to the newspapers. This is one of the ways for women who worked in the industries to become familiar with what we're doing and contact us. And in mm-hmm. looking at the photographs, it was interesting. Some of them, the overalls were slightly different than, say, yeah. a woman in the industry would wear today. But except for the hairdo, it would be very hard to know that it was the 40s.
Yeah.
I mean, the ones with the snood made it quite obvious, but it was quite difficult to know in many respects that it was from the 40s.
Well, these are some words, a ladies' airplane. And you can just take these and look at them at your leisure.
What are these out of?
These are out of the Douglas Airview, which is a magazine put out every month.
And is there a complete collection of that at the museum?
Pretty much, yeah. Uh-huh. We may miss two or threes.
Oh, good.
But here, these are from...
Oh, thank you.
Part of that. Mm-hmm. You can look at them at your leisure.
Was that basically the Clint newspaper?
No, it's not a newspaper. It's a magazine. Mm-hmm. And it's a good authoritative magazine. And I think that if you get into it at the museum, that This happened to be a very flimsy
copy,
but you see, it was a Douglas Air View, and then they have some good ads of the days. And First Around the World Again, and then they'll have something and various things. This is a very thin one, but you would want to look at the ones in pre-World War II.
From about 39 to 46.
Yeah,
or so.
Now this is 45, see. And this is exceptionally thin.
Was that designed for the Douglas employees or more for the... It was.
Yeah, it was an internal.
Was there also a newspaper at each of the plants?
Mm-hmm.
And does the museum have those newspapers as well?
Some not. Those are the hardest to get. Uh-huh. The Douglas Company has some. This is the newspaper. I don't hear said Tommy Dorsey when comes in.
Well, I remember what you're mentioning that in your little piece about the entertainment during the noontime.
Yeah, right. So in here you'll find weekly information, this type of thing. And I just happen to have two sections of it that I happen to pick up and keep.
But they do have it at the Long Beach plant. They do have copies of it?
Uh-huh. They should have. Again, it would be Harry Gann.
Mm.
Tim Tyler. Your best bet is to go through Tim Tyler, who is paid to take care of external relations problems.
Okay.
And there are people in the library and so forth. That
oh, marvelous. Because those are the sorts of things that it's very helpful to really, I know we're getting permission now to go out to the Lockheed Record Center to go through their company newspapers, and I'm trying to round up to determine where exactly the Vaultee materials are. I imagine they're in San Diego somewhere.
Yeah, there's quite a story in back on Vaultee. There's a fellow that... I've done a little work with, was writing a book that could touch on Vaultee.
Oh.
Vaultee, see, Jack Northrop, Vaultee, Douglas and Bell, and Martin, all the pioneer names in aviation of the old-timers, many of them worked at Douglas. Douglas was kind of a training place. Dutch Kindleberger came out of there, Northrop came out of there, Bell had worked for Doug Sr., and a number of others, Jerry Vaultee had worked with Douglas, and there are some interesting slants on Vaultee that this fellow, Jim Donahue, might give you. I may have some of his name here.
Is he in the Los Angeles area?
Yeah, he's writing a book and has been in touch with these key people, Jack Northrop and others, quite regularly. So Donahue, they tell me, Ira Chart tells me, and so do others, that Donahue's upcoming book is going to be an exceptionally good book. He seems to have the feel for it. I can get you the number. I don't have it here, apparently. We touch base with him occasionally.
Was Vega part of the network, too? Where did the Vega come from?
Well, Vega... You're getting into Lockheed history there, and Vega was an offshoot of a Lockheed company. See, Lockheed wanted to, Bob Gross had the idea of breaking down into three elements, the so-called light plane, the commercial aircraft, and the military aircraft. And they tried to break the plant up into, or the company up into sections that would cover these fields. Now everybody tries to do the same thing. It's where is the market?
Mm-hmm.
And So Vega turned out to be the center for building the B-17s, the flying fortresses. It quickly developed into that. And have you seen that book, The Lockheed Story?
No, I'm just beginning to collect those materials.
Yeah, the book that, and Northrop has put one out, others have put them out. They're company books.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can send to Lockheed and get this called Days of Trial and Triumph. And in there, it'll cover the transition of the old days. And they also have other publications. Now, this happens to cover the Vega factory here. It says, in 1938, Vega Airplane Company, the Lockheed subsidiary formed in 1937, bought 30 acres next to Union Aerodrome and began building a plant to build Ventura bombers for Britain. That's before the war.
Mm-hmm.
Vega merged with Lockheed in 1943. Its offices now house corporate and Lockheed California personnel. Well, that's up to date.
Mm-hmm.
But in between, they built close to 3,000 B-17s, so it was a main B-17 factory.
Now, did Douglas ever put out this sort of public relations company history?
Yeah, well, they do in pieces. If you came over to the library, they would undoubtedly dig out various smaller ones.
Uh-huh.
This is one that they have a number of over there,
uh-huh,
called the Santa Monica Story. Well, it isn't as complete as that, but it does.
And you've got copies of all these sorts of things over in the museum.
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful.
So none of these, see, when you start looking into something, as you know, it isn't as thorough and it doesn't have the depth that
right.
you'd like to have. And that's the disappointing thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then they show DC-9 uh-huh. and DC-8 and DC-10, just nose ends for the conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
But there are things like this available over there. And they have them on the airlines. Let's see, TWA put one out on its airline, but you back into history because they bought an airplane. Well, and who made it and how, where did it come from and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I had a call yesterday on, there's some big program being put together by CBS on early aviation.
Mm-hmm.
And this fellow, I don't know whether I had told him or something, come up about the DC-2 and 3 had a statement on the side. Oh, no, he saw the DC-2 we have at the airport. It was parked over in a corner, and up on the top it said the Lindbergh line, TWA markings on it. Well, this baffled them, and they hadn't thought of Lindbergh tied in. Well, for a while, Lindbergh was a technical consultant for TWA.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to use his name to advantage with the passenger traffic, TWA just put in script type writing just above the row of windows the Lindbergh line. And I don't think it was up there very long when they dropped it. And Lindbergh was their technical consultant. In fact, Lindbergh was the one that handled the technical side of the first Douglas commercial, the DC-1, that TWA bought. And they had to sell Lindbergh on its flying ability and all the things like that.
Yeah.
Now, I ran through at random some things that I know you'd probably ask. They're not in any order. I just wrote them as I thought of them. Now, one thing, and this has to do with women in World War II. a thing that's overlooked considerably is the fact that women were trained in the use of hand tools. They had the kitchen implements, the mixmaster and the rest of the gadgets and so forth. So they were, it wasn't unusual for them then to pick a drill motor up or something like that and hear a high rev noise like a mixer. So that meant they didn't come in just fumbling. Fact of the matter is, they probably, a good housewife would outperform many males that came in that had never done anything, never fixed a tire in a car or anything. So they did have an advantage that's very obscure.
Mm-hmm.
We did simplify manufacturing operations for both male and female, and we foolproofed tooling. We could take one person, it'd be male or female, running a drill press, and they only drilled certain holes, and they did that all day long, day after day after day. Well, the drill fixture that held the part, we used to have it, they called foolproof. You couldn't get the part in the fixture to drill it without putting it in right.
Mm.
And we found that was necessary as the green help started mm-hmm. coming in. So a woman would do this one job. Well, before the war, the fellow that drilled those holes did other things, too. He may have done 10 operations to complete that part. But when the war came along, and you had more people and more parts going through, you found it convenient to teach single skills so they'd do the same thing every day,
mm-hmm.
like that. Well, along came the union that organized the plant, and the CIO at the time. And this meant that the people that were working in the machine shop doing this drilling then acquired a takeoff point for seniority. And yet they were not a machinist.
They were called operators.
Yeah.
I see.
And then if they stayed long enough, chances are they'd get upgraded, which tend to happen, and they'd require the title of a machinist for doing simple operations. Then the war ended, or we began laying off mm-hmm. near the end of the war, and then the war ended, and they had seniority, and they'd be at least an operator A. Well, then there were a lot of young people who were starting their careers, coming back from the military with excellent backgrounds, and it was kind of natural for them to want to be mechanics, a life's work. They'd get bumped out because some woman had been there longer, and yet that woman didn't have the multiple skills that mm-hmm. fellow had that wanted the job.
Now, after the war, was there a return to the multiple skills, or were the jobs still broken down?
No, you had to return because you had fewer employees to build an airplane. The rate of building was down lower, and so it took fewer employees. And then we went back to the pre-World War II deal of you should be able to do multiple operations.
So then you had people who would set up the machines themselves, too, and set up the dies, that sort of thing.
The set-up people. They would then have to learn to set up all things. And the difference between people were classed A, B, and C. And that was simple
mm-hmm.
to understand. The C would be the lower skill. Well, the difference between the C and the B and the B and the A would always be some controversial point between the union and the company, because the people would be after the union to get upgraded.
Mm-hmm.
The company isn't advancing me.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd get quite vocal about that. And if there was an opening, you could find a woman that wanted to get into that spot. And on the basis that, well, she'll learn. you can't deny that one person might learn quickly
mm-hmm.
and do a good job in the absence of experience. So she'd do that and get that job. Then, if she couldn't do the work, there was a period during which she could qualify to do the job. And if she couldn't,
mm-hmm.
then you could demonstrate to the union that she can't do this work. And then the union, in most cases, then would allow you to drop her back to something she could do. Or, in many cases, it resulted in a dismissal because there was no other job available.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a bumping procedure that went on. If you wanted to go down the scale, obviously if you were an A, and there was a C job open, rather than hire somebody off the street,
mm-hmm.
an A or a B could take the C job. It was quite a problem.
Now, the union came in, I gather from your account, relatively later, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. There had been a union at Santa Monica.
No, was that a
skill union?
Oh.
The AFL.
Oh, the
American Federation.
The International Association of Machinists.
And IAM
uh-huh.
and AFL. And see, there were these unions around, and the IAM would be at Santa Monica. There was always a welders union, and there was other unions.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm talking about the big group
mm-hmm.
that's unionized, the mm-hmm. factory workers. And there were always skill unions around, and Santa Monica had them. They were under AFL-IAM type of operation. And Long Beach went CIO, which was another union.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the war, there was a real problem, too, highly skilled Douglas people who had been with the company for years had to they'd lose their job because they were now in another union, CIO, and they couldn't get back to Santa Monica. So a deal was made that we were able to select 100 of the top skills and move them from the CIO to the Santa Monica.
Oh.
Machine machine.
Now, what about in El Segundo? Was that also true of the El Segundo plant?
No, I can't comment too well on El Segundo. Every plant and company had the problem. CIO, Committee of Industrial Organization, or whatever, the HICO was it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were a union that was out to sweep in all the people that couldn't find a place in the skill unions.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an industrial type
mm-hmm.
of union, quite different from the old skill unions. So every plant had the same problem because the CIO was around trying to organize them. We were working three shifts. Not all plants worked three shifts, companies. We did. And we had a peculiar thing before the war got started. I was in a division called the Tooling Division for a while, and we were not allowed to hire women, even as typists or stenographers, secretaries or anything. I had a male secretary.
By not allowed during the company policy?
Well, by a division policy within the company. Other divisions, engineering did, others had women secretaries, and they did other things, or some in engineering and so forth. But in this one division, which is a major element of the business, you basically have engineering, tooling, and the shop,
mm-hmm.
fabricators and assemblers. So this tooling division had this peculiar policy. And we all had, I had a young fellow, a male secretary who was a whiz. Gosh, he was good. High school graduate.
Mm.
But sensitive and alert. And, couldn't have done better. Now, We had a typing pool with some, say, 30 typists in. The pool idea goes on and off for a while. Well, we'll lick all this paperwork by having a pool to do the typing and get the things in there, and that doesn't work. And then they finally decentralize it back to individuals. This time we're in the pool phase. And it's pretty hard to hire, say, 30 typists, male typists, without getting some pretty weird people. And, you'd have the little problems of winning each other's affection within the group. You know, they date each other and take turns in wearing women's clothes and things like that.
To work?
No, they didn't do the work because they wouldn't get in, so mm-hmm. they'd be screened out. But they would come in with makeup on from being out the night before. Well, this really was a mess. And finally, the order came through to break up because these people should be going into the army. So I had taken my secretary and reclassified him as a planner B, which I was able to do at the time. So when knowing that we had to get rid of this ridiculous setup, and so when it came time for him to go into the shop or in the army, he already had accumulated some company seniority as a planner, and he turned out to be a good one and retired about 3 years ago and did an excellent job. But I was just happened to be lucky because they just walk in from personality, you don't know who you're going to get.
So what they did then was try to gradually phase women into the pool as a way to get rid of these
gradual.
Men.
It was one of those things.
It was a clean sweep.
Yeah, right now. And it was kind of hectic. And then we hired an awful lot of high school kids.
Now, was this still when you were still in Santa
this
Monica during
Beach.
The planning phase, or you were already in Long Beach?
The male stenos and so forth, typing pool, that was at Santa Monica. Mm-hmm. And that got broken up by the time we moved to Long mm-hmm. Beach. The Long Beach plant never had this problem.
I see. One of the questions that I wanted to clarify with you was when you talked about the management problem that went on for almost 2 years,
yeah.
you seemed to be referring to Long Beach, yet it was before the actual move was made.
Well, the problem with management, the old-timers were being phased out, the ones that had hand-built airplanes and so forth, and they were the ones that you handed them a blueprint and they made the part. They ordered the material, they made the tools to make the part before they did anything, and they sat down and planned the job.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we moved planning from the shop up into specialists who wrote on a piece of paper how to machine or mm-hmm. whatever fabricate the part. Well, the shop people, nobody can sit in a desk way up in the corner up there and tell me how to make this part. So stating an attitude mm-hmm. that was taking place at that time. And the same thing was in management. They were, to hell with the paperwork, let's build airplanes. That was you were sure to be well recognized as the right kind of guy in management if you just condemned the paperwork all the time and said we ought to be making parts and we ought to be making airplanes. That was a very common attitude. Well, gradually that type had to be moved out so that you could plan your work. They're using that old saw of plan your work, then work your plan
mm-hmm.
type of thing. So a new group came in. Well, like myself.
Mm-hmm.
And we moved in and were more interested in systematizing and planning thing before you waste labor on trying to manufacture them, because engineering drawings weren't always correct. And in this country, you don't build the airplane like the engineer designs it. You do a different set of planning. In Europe, they literally take the engineering drawing and build the airplane from the drawings. But here, the planner sits down, he's a manufacturing engineer, and he makes a cost analysis of all the parts, and he decides maybe to leave the holes out and drill at a later time, or put in what we call pilot holes that locate a little small hole, so when you get ready to use the part, you drill out that small hole, but the worker has no problem because all he sees is a bunch of small holes that he knows now have to be drilled out for big holes. There was quite a change in both the customer, the Army Air Corps at the time, and the people in the plant to start to think their way through to get the job done, rather than drive your way through. I used a phrase at the time, and I don't know where I ever picked it up, was he's a man of action, no time lost in thinking. And there were people that fitted that beautifully. And it was surefire to be caught looking busy and being industrious and that sort of thing. It didn't matter whether you were doing anything worthwhile or not. You created an appearance. And unfortunately, as lower levels of management walk by and so forth, they see a very industrious type, and you are attracted to it. And you notice every time I walk through this department, that guy is working harder than anybody else. Well, the thing that you had to learn was that as soon as a stranger walks or a member of management comes into a department, you grab a mallet or a hammer or something, and you just start beating on the closest thing, see, just like this, because that motion tends to convey the impression that you're doing something. And there are people that practice that. Past masters and secretaries would sit. I was talking with a corporate secretary yesterday on this deal, and we were talking about how the secretaries even would sit down and copy forms, just type them out. But the old keyboard was rattling, you know, and you walk through, they were busy. And so it wasn't confined to just a shop. There were people that did that any place.
Well, was there a whole management team that was set up in Santa Monica for the Long Beach plant before the actual move, in other words?
What they first set up, they projectized. We had two basic airplanes going through, which I think I mentioned that in the book, and the C-47 and the A-20B. And there was another one that was canceled. It was an observation airplane, the O-52. And so we planned we didn't know it was the Long Beach plant. We didn't know where the plant would be, but it doesn't make any difference. You can take a five-story building or a roundhouse. The basic plan has to be laid down. You make little cutouts, and you show the airplane production line in little cutouts made with cookie cutters, we call them. Almost literally that. They're stamped out in pieces. The management... to do that, you could use the old-style management because they did know how to put an airplane together. And their input was very valuable. But a number of us had started in the 30s and worked on airplanes under the old style, too. So we were pretty thoroughly drilled on the so-called old style of manufacturing. So when the high production rates came in, we just didn't plod through the same old methods. We had some people who moved out to try new things and cope with the demands of production and things like that, but there were others the same way. They wanted to do something. So it took a while for this to be evident that the old-timers were really old-timers and didn't fit. And the military found it out first, the customer, because they were dealing with them. And enough reports went to corporate management and so forth to where changes were made in management. And the first change made in the Long Beach plant, it wasn't very productive. They put an engineer in at the head, and he was a detailist. He liked to talk about this little thing that was being machined. He just knew it by heart. But the whole administrative plan for the factory was just running itself. And so they finally hit on a fellow by the name of Hubens, who and I had been working for a while. He was a strong disciplinarian. And of course, there are many ways to accomplish the building of airplanes. You might have could justify a half a dozen ways of building all these DC-3s or C-47s, whatever. But the main thing is not to keep analyzing it, but to pick one of the systems, and it may not be the best one. Pick one, and with strong discipline, make it work. So a poor concept, well executed, is better than waiting for the perfection. And there is a tendency of a number of people to wait for that perfect solution to it, because there's something wrong with nearly everything, see? And so Huygens had the right approach. Take a plan of action. And then stick to it and give the people a hard time that wouldn't follow it. And gradually we got rid of the people who didn't like it. And they just, some of them were smart enough to see it should have been done, but they were stubborn because they put 20 years in and they had never had to do it that way. And I don't like it. There were some of those. And there were others that were just bewildered why their methods were no longer any good, and a wholesale condemning of paper. And my God, the paper began to flow in enormous quantities. It'd be nothing to have 150,000 work orders in the fabricating shops at one time, and that's an awful lot of paper. And so you found that there were certain goals set by the customer when he had to have things, a schedule, and changes invariably came along, and that was probably the biggest mistake of the old management. They didn't know how to incorporate changes. And engineers would be working on the change, and the shop and tooling hadn't even heard of it yet. And this was a tragic thing. So I would say the change control was the biggest item causing change in management.
But it wasn't until everyone was actually settled into the new Long Beach plant that it really occurred.
In the middle of 1942, before we really saw changes begin to take place that made sense.
But wasn't the actual occupation of the plant only in 42?
Well, no. The plant started... the planning was done... Actually, we were working on concepts of it in 39 because the British and the French put large demands on for aircraft. And by 1940, of course, in that red book, plans, they know they have to have additional plants, but there was this concept of not building any more plants on either coast, during the coastline. And so we went ahead and planned in the 40s and 41. We planned for a plant to handle, in this case, the A-20 and the C-47. And we laid the plant out just like we knew where it was going to be and everything. There was just a handful of us working on it. And it was in a special way, projectized, you know, and had some security on it. And so when the plant was located at Long Beach and was built, we just took these plans and moved them into the plant.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they just died in there because that's where the management didn't rely on any of this pre-planning.
Oh, I see.
See, and it was an unfortunate thing that nobody bothered to train them too, you know. There were probably some that could have made the transition had they been given sufficient training.
Mm-hmm.
But you weren't trained. You were just dumped into the spot. So the plant, and I had someplace here. I want to show you a couple of pictures. It will give you a little flavor of I'll just lay them on here to make it easier to see. Well, that was just I'm still looking for this ball. It was at the entrance to the plant.
Hmm.
But that was the old entrance to the plant. Now there's a big tower up here, see?
Mm-hmm.
Down Douglas at the top. But you begin to look at the dates here, see?
Uh-huh.
And you get, here's building number 7, management building. This July 1942 was taken. There was...
Now, would that be Lakewood Boulevard?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Right here, right there. That was the main Douglas plant. There's the ball again, see?
Mm-hmm.
Now, inside, these things here are the old smoke pots they used for the citrus groves.
Mm-hmm.
We used them to try to help camouflage the plant.
Oh.
The little trees.
Did you have that? Did this plant have that roof camouflage?
Yeah, I'll show you. Now here shows the plant getting pretty well along. Again, these in 42, and the sandbags here to dive behind. Later, bomb shelters were introduced. And again, you can see the sandbags.
Mm.
Big mistake. We put sandbags inside. This building was a machine shop, mainly, and. We put sandbags inside, and the sand was wet in some cases, and the bags would rot. They were probably made in prisons, you know, in the jute mills and so forth. And the bags would rot, and then they'd run these little you've seen these little tow trains that haul parts around. The guy would cut the corner a little too sharp, and he would hit the sandbags, and the sand would run out, and the first thing you know, the sand was getting up into the machines, and we had a hell of a mess there. Until we had sense enough to get rid of the sandbags. So these, again, are just shots of the old building, but you see the plant's pretty well along in the middle of 42.
I see.